Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. President Obama is about to address the United Nations General Assembly, including in his speech the idea of a UN-created Palestinian state, or his response to that idea, and more. We will listen to some of the speech live once it begins. Joining us now to preview the speech for just a second before this begins, and we'll talk about it afterwards also, is Steve Clemens, Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic, and Editor-in-Chief now of Atlantic Live Online. Hi, Steve. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you, Brian.
So the American president speaks every year at the UN General Assembly. Does it matter what he says, or is it just a formality?
No, I think he sets benchmarks from year to year. One of the really interesting ones is that there hasn't been a General Assembly speech that Barack Obama hasn't given where he spent quite a bit of time on the Israeli-Palestinian standoff. And, of course, we know that later this week, Palestine is going to be initiated in an effort to be recognized as a state. So I don't know what he's going to focus on this year, but I think they're wishing that would go away. But the president has used this as an important opportunity to talk about efforts of other nations to stand against nuclear weapons and the proliferation of WMD materials. I think he may be looking at this as an opportunity to talk about what's happening in the Arab Spring and the importance of supporting democracies around the world. I think that'll be a key part of his speech today.
You know,
it is important from a benchmark perspective.
Give me a brief history of maybe the last 10 years. I don't know if we can do that before the speech begins, but, you know, since the 9/11 attacks, there's been a lot of drama around presidential speeches at the United Nations, the way President Bush used the UN while trying to discredit it in the run-up to the Iraq War, because that was one of the barriers to the Iraq War, a position at the United Nations. So how did Bush use the UN and these September speeches while at the same time trying to downplay the legitimacy and the power of the institution?
Well, I think George Bush had a very different style and posture than President Obama has adopted. President Bush, particularly during the years when John Bolton was the recess-appointed ambassador there, used it as an opportunity to talk about America's great causes in the world. His speeches were high on the issues of values and democracy and the righteousness, essentially, and the rightness of the United States in pursuing this around the world and trying to use that moment in the UN to shame other leaders into if not behaving, into sort of fearing what the United States may bring along. I think that can be an effective strategy. You know, if the world is full of some tough thugs now and then, and many of them get an opportunity to come to New York and speak at the UN as well. In fact, last year I ran into Muammar Gaddafi in the hallway with some of his people, and actually he stopped and we had a kind of an exchange, not much in English, but we had an encounter, which was interesting. The UN General Assembly is a fascinating place where you can
Minute. Steve, what do you ask Muammar Gaddafi when you run into him? How's the nurse, or what's the question?
He had seen me on CNN actually talking about his tent and the tent controversy, or someone had played it for him, because I had made the comment that we were distracted from big issues, and the big issue was that Muammar Gaddafi had given up his nuclear weapons program, and that was a box that we, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, had checked off and could be feel proud of. Mm-hmm. And it's why Gaddafi shouldn't be written off, and I think he liked that. That comment. So that's why he just recognized me from the television. So it was definitely for me an awkward moment. But that's part of what can happen up there. I was there 1 year, and Gordon Brown went by in a hurried way with literally about 40 apparatchiks following him. And you know, Gordon Brown usually has this sort of clunky and slow, somewhat sluggish style, but he was literally racing through. So everyone has their own style and things that they bring to the General Assembly, but for them it's a moment of theater in which they're trying to communicate to the rest of the world their national priorities and what they care about, what their alliances are like. Sometimes they become anti-Israel rants, they become anti-U.S. rants, but from the United States and what George Bush and people like Bill Clinton and I think President Obama have done, they generally try and use them as a way to outline and articulate what we would consider to be what is responsible global stakeholding look like. What are we doing with regards to nuclear weapons, WMDs, climate change? What are the big problems out there that we can collectively solve? And as I said, even Bush would do this. Bush would speak to these various issues and lay out things and try and not use them.
And we're going to go live to the General Assembly now. It's Steve Clemens from the New America Foundation in The Atlantic, who runs into Gordon Brown and Muammar Gaddafi in the hallways. President Obama shaking hands with the Secretary General, now at the podium, speaking his first few words.
Of the United Nations, the pursuit of peace in an imperfect world. War and conflict have been with us since the beginning of civilizations. But in the first part of the 20th century, the advance of modern weaponry led to death on a staggering scale. It was this killing that compelled the founders of this body to build an institution that was focused not just on ending one war, but on averting others. A union of sovereign states that would seek to prevent conflict while also addressing its causes. No American did more to pursue this objective than President Franklin Roosevelt. He knew that a victory in war was not enough. As he said at one of the very first meetings on the founding of the United Nations, we have got to make not merely peace, but a peace that will last. The men and women who built this institution understood that peace is more than just the absence of war. A lasting peace for nations and for individuals depends on a sense of justice and opportunity, of dignity and freedom. It depends on struggle and sacrifice, on compromise, and on a sense of common humanity. One delegate to the San Francisco conference that led to the creation of the United Nations put it well. Many people, she said, have talked as if all that has to be done to get peace was to say loudly and frequently that we love peace and we hated war. Now we have learned that no matter how much we love peace and hate war, we cannot avoid having war brought upon us if there are convulsions in other parts of the world. The fact is, peace is hard. But our people demand it. Over nearly seven decades, even as the United Nations helped avert a third world war, we still live in a world scarred by conflict and plagued by poverty. Even as we proclaim our love for peace and our hatred of war, there are still convulsions in our world that endanger us all. I took office at a time of two wars for the United States. Moreover, the violent extremists who drew us into war in the first place, Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda organization, remained at large. Today, we've set a new direction. At the end of this year, America's military operation in Iraq will be over. We will have a normal relationship with a sovereign nation that is a member of the community of nations. That equal partnership will be strengthened by our support for Iraq, for its government, and for its security forces, for its people, and for their aspirations. As we end the war in Iraq, the United States and our coalition partners have begun a transition in Afghanistan. between now and 2014, an increasingly capable Afghan government and security forces will step forward to take responsibility for the future of their country. As they do, we are drawing down our own forces while building an enduring partnership with the Afghan people. So let there be no doubt, the tide of war is receding. When I took office, roughly 180,000 Americans were serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. By the end of this year, that number will be cut in half, and it will continue to decline. This is critical for the sovereignty of Iraq and Afghanistan. It's also critical to the strength of the United States as we build our nation at home. Moreover, we are poised to end these wars from a position of strength. 10 years ago, there was an open wound and twisted steel, a broken heart in the center of this city. Today, as a new tower is rising at Ground Zero, it symbolizes New York's renewal, even as Al-Qaeda is under more pressure than ever before. Its leadership has been degraded, and Osama bin Laden, a man who murdered thousands of people from dozens of countries, will never endanger the peace of the world again. So yes, this has been a difficult decade. But today we stand at a crossroads of history with the chance to move decisively in the direction of peace. To do so, we must return to the wisdom of those who created this institution. The United Nations founding charter calls upon us to unite our strength to maintain international peace and security. And Article 1 of this General Assembly's Universal Declaration of Human Rights reminds us that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and in rights. Those bedrock beliefs in the responsibility of states and the rights of men and women must be our guide. And in that effort, we have reason to hope. This year has been a time of extraordinary transformation. More nations have stepped forward to maintain international peace and security. And more individuals are claiming their universal right to live in freedom and dignity. Think about it. 1 year ago, when we met here in New York, the prospect of a successful referendum in South Sudan was in doubt. But the international community overcame old divisions to support the agreement that had been negotiated to give South Sudan self-determination. And last summer, as a new flag went up in Juba, former soldiers laid down their arms, men and women wept with joy, and children finally knew the promise of looking to a future that they will shape. 1 year ago, the people of Cote d'Ivoire approached a landmark election. And when the incumbent lost and refused to respect the results, the world refused to look the other way. UN peacekeepers were harassed, but they did not leave their posts. The Security Council, led by the United States and Nigeria and France, came together to support the will of the people. And Cote d'Ivoire is now governed by the man who was elected to lead.
President Obama speaking live at the United Nations. We'll dip back in a minute when he gets to the Israel-Palestine part. Steve Clemens from the New America Foundation and The Atlantic is with us. Steve, I want to actually preview what the president is going to say about the Palestinian statehood issue, because that's what everybody's anticipating, and we have the transcript now. And he's not going to say, don't do this, in so many words. I don't know if you've gotten to read this yet.
I have not.
But he acknowledges, quote, America's commitment to Israel's security is unshakable, and our friendship with Israel is deep and enduring. The Jewish people carry the burdens of centuries of exile, persecution, and the fresh memory of knowing that 6 million were killed simply because of who they were. The Jewish people have forged a successful state in their historic homeland. Israel deserves recognition. normal relations with its neighbors and friends of the Palestinians do them no favors by ignoring this truth, just as friends of Israel must recognize the need to pursue a two-state solution with a secure Israel next to an independent Palestine. And he goes on to say that truth, that each side has legitimate aspirations, is what makes peace so hard, and the deadlock will only be broken when each side learns to stand in each other's shoes. That's what we should be encouraging. And then says, we will only succeed in that effort if we encourage the parties to sit down together, to listen to each other, and to understand each other's hopes and fears. And that is what the United Nations should be focused on in the weeks and months to come. So that, in relatively a lot of words, I think will be the president saying, we do not support the idea of the United Nations creating a Palestinian state outside of the context of a negotiated peace with Israel.
Well, I do think that's where he's going to go and try to lay out a track that would rationalize why we would veto a Palestinian-led resolution in the Security Council. The problem is that in the eyes of the rest of the world, they see the United States somewhat acquiescing to the reality that there are no negotiations, and not using obvious leverage that we have with Israel to encourage Israel to be more forthcoming, since it really sets the temperature in the region as the only regional superpower. And thus, you know, one of the things that, you know, I feel is really unfortunate in this, but I understand where it's coming from the Palestinian side, is that in the eyes of many people in the Arab world, the part of the Palestinian equation that has the attention of Israel is Hamas, and that Hamas, who may kidnap soldiers and fire rockets, nonetheless are the ones that move Israel's political system now and then to respond, whereas Palestine's moderates have never achieved never been able to get that same kind of attention and results for their people. And thus, what Mahmoud Abbas is doing now is he's basically taking in what I consider to be sort of a Gandhi approach. He's inventing political leverage without violence, and it's making a lot of players, including in Washington, very upset. But it is interesting to watch that the situation won't allow itself to be ignored, that you can't just acquiesce to nothing moving, and that's the situation we're in now. So I understand the president's comments, but at the same time, it's very clear that the status quo isn't acceptable either. And as my friend at The Atlantic, Jeff Goldberg, has written somewhat critically of President Netanyahu, Israel is missing its moment as well in this.
What would Israel's moment be in this?
Well, ironically, you know, this may be too cute for people. The strategy that some of us who feel we know Israel pretty well, and some that you would consider to be very close to the AIPAC line, have said, you know, it would have been smart for the United States and Israel to accept this resolution, that it doesn't solve any of the problems on borders and security and kind of broad issues. But recognizing the broad issue that Palestine is and is sort of functioning as a state with these unresolved issues that still need to be negotiated, actually fits with Israeli policy, and it would have required a de facto recognition back of Israel's right to exist, because all member nations have to recognize the sovereignty and existence of other nations. And so it would have actually given Israel, in part, what it wanted and demanded, which is recognition of its right to exist as a Jewish state, and in a de facto way, and would have given Palestine its right to exist, but without solving any of the contentious problems that will continue to plague this issue for a while.
We just have a minute left, and then we have Governor Mitch Daniels of Indiana, who's going to join us next. I think it's important to note that there's so much focus on the Palestinian statehood proposal that I believe it's sucking all the air out of the room at the United Nations to talk about other things that the UN is supposed to be centrally about, like global poverty and development in the poor world, staving off environmental destruction, war and peace questions on every continent, not just between Israelis and Palestinians, ending unnecessary disease, education, the really big issues that affect billions of people around the world. And certainly including the Mideast, of course, but not a single issue thing. And it seems to me that a lot of all of that that we often talk about with respect to the UN General Assembly is getting lost because everybody is like Israel, Palestine, Israel, Palestine.
I think you're absolutely right. I was on the phone earlier this week with Rajiv Shah, our USAID administrator, and he was doing some preview calls and discussions of the president's speech and position as being a year where development and many of the issues you just laid out, women's issues and women's empowerment, global economy development, dealing with some of these terrific environmental impacts was going to be more of this. And I actually thought when I was listening to President Obama, he was going to go more into that more quickly. You have the speech and I don't. But when he talked about FDR saying this needs to be not merely peace, but a peace that will last, that was the natural opener, not just to talk about the drawdown of American forces and the wind down of some of these wars, but what is our ongoing responsibility to the rest of the world outside of those military and Department of Defense accounts? Where is our aid going? What are our commitments to women and the human rights agenda and the global refugee crisis and whatnot. Yes. So
it is a pretty singularly focused speech, as I browse through it, on war and peace and the Middle East in general, not just Israeli-Palestinian, but the Arab Spring, but primarily war and peace. Next hour on this show, we're going to be looking at a new creation of the State Department called a slave map, where people can actually use an interactive tool to see what products that we buy in our ordinary lives are created on one level or another by slaves, by child trafficking, human trafficking of people of all ages. And that's one of the UN's big issues. It's not coming up in the president's speech, and the media is kind of ignoring it too for the most part. So I just wanted to note that. We will see what happens with the reaction to the president's address, particularly on Israel-Palestine, as the day goes on. If you want to listen to the rest of the president's speech live, you can right now on our politics website. It'sAFreeCountry.org. Coming up here on the radio next, we have Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, who decided not to run for president, but he's got a lot of interesting things to say, including that the Romney Perry exchanges on Social Security are not advancing the debate, in his opinion. So Steve Clemens from The Atlantic and the New America Foundation, thank you very much for getting us going around the president's address today.
Thank you, Brian.
And Mitch Daniels next. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.